that I think that we've, crossed the Rubicon. I don't necessarily believe in the idea of cycles anymore. I think that the market participant and the way that Bitcoin trades is going to be radically different from the past. Why did Bitcoin cycles happen? Because retail, what they tend to do, and small ticket investors and people that aren't professional investors, what they tend to do is they tend to FOMO in and they tend to FOMO out. And institutional investors do this too. And so the composition of people in Bitcoin has changed. And so I think what we probably get is we get a new dynamic that is going to look a lot more like gold than Bitcoin of 2017 or 2021.
Hey everyone, if you have been listening to Empire, you know that Santi and I are fed up with unaffordable fees and frustrating transaction speeds that make the on-chain experience basically unusable. So the Arbitrum team reached out and they showed us the platform. They showed us what you can do on Arbitrum. Whatever you're doing, you can experience frictionless transactions at lightning speed on Arbitrum. So head over to portal.arbitrum.io and check it out. Scary stat for you. The odds of falling victim to online crimes are 1 in 4. Aura provides digital security protection to keep your personal information, passwords, online activity, and technology safe from online threats. For Empire listeners, Aura is offering 14 days free plus up to 55% off an Aura subscription when you visit Aura, aura.com/blockworks. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details. You'll hear more about Aura later in the show. Hey everyone, Santi and I have been talking about Solana a lot recently, and we're excited to have a Solana sponsor of Empire, Marinade. Marinade is a staking protocol on Solana and the only stake pool that delivers auto rebalancing, MEV rewards, and automatic downside protection with their new protected staking rewards. Optimize your SOL stake with Marinade by hitting the link in the show notes. Big thanks to Marinade. We'll talk more about them later in the show. Are you tired of high gas fees? Well, I'm excited to let you know about Scale, a zero gas fee modular blockchain that's become a perfect fit for gaming and AI apps because of their instant finality and lack of MEV. Explore the Scale ecosystem today at scale.space/ecosystem and stay up to date with the gasless blockchain on X at Scale Network. That's at Scale Network. Big thanks to Scale for sponsoring Empire. All right. What's up, everyone? We got Santi and then we got Avi, and we've eliminated Jonah from this. We're doing a trading and macro and, where are we at in the market conversation? But Jonah has been eliminated, and in his place we have Ro.
He's been liquidated.
He's been liquidated. Yeah, we've got Ro. Ro's a legend, been in the space for a while. Was at Genesis for a while, deeply understands the like credit and trading space, and now is on the venture side at Hack. So Avi, Ro, welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you. I already miss Jonah. Maybe we can bring him on another time as like a special guest. But Ro's great.
We'll
Ro's
see
great.
How Ro
I
does.
Love you too, Ro.
Yeah, hopefully I don't disappoint you, Avi. Thank you, as always.
So Avi, your market's dumped and you left Saint-Tropez, huh?
Yeah, immediately. I couldn't afford it anymore. I will say it's like amazing still, no matter where you travel in this world, no matter how expensive anything is, New York, just when you come back, it's like still the most expensive place in the world.
Not really.
Yeah. So Santi's like, oh, really? Like, I'll one up you.
Definitely. Yeah. Talking about experience, it is definitely not. Like, Dubai is a. I was just there for Duncan 2049. Like, real estate prices in Dubai are like the same or more expensive in London. Of course, all Russians have moved there, but like, there's a reason. Like, real estate services are not cheap at all there. Nor are they in Singapore, Hong Kong, and Paris, London, Monaco.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not talking real estate. Real estate, I don't want to compete with places like Monaco. That's crazy, the stuff that goes on there. But in terms of going out, getting food, just like buying anything from a store. It's staying in hotels. New York is still crazy expensive. We're in Saint-Tropez for 2 weeks. Got a 2-bedroom villa, like $500 a night.
So wait, let me get this straight. You left Saint-Tropez. The markets are doing the thing. I heard you say that you're incredibly bearish. You have been bearish for a while. So when did this bearishness permeate into your system? Because Soros has been shorting the market for the last 12 years and lost like a couple billion bucks on it. So at what point did you start becoming bearish?
I mean, you can track it on the on the pod and my public statements. But basically, after we failed to break 73K three times, and ETF inflows started going down, stablecoin market cap stopped going up. You know, when I say incredibly bearish, I'm not talking about 25K. I'm not talking about 15K. I'm just talking about, hey, it's very reasonable and possible that we can trade 50, 52, you know, and it's very possible that alts go down 70, 80%. And so far, that's actually happened in a lot of cases. I mean, a lot of alts are down 50% since I first started talking about this. And I just always go back to my base case, which is, do you know what made you money? Do you understand why you made the money that you did? And if I look at the market, why did we make the money that we did? Why did everything go up? Why were things so amazing? It's because of the ETF trade. That was it. That was the key. And so now that the ETF trade is closed, we have the ETF. The inflows have slowed down. We're starting to get outflows. There's no edge in predicting that those flows are going to come back. There's no, oh, you know, I figured it out in exactly 4 weeks, these are going to come back. So my view, whenever the trade is over, is you just step back, you de-risk, and you just watch. And so that's my take right now, is I have no way of telling you whether this is going to go to 70K or 50K first, but I'm leaning towards 50 because the trade is over.
And so conversely, let me ask you a question. Like, so like the ETF, you know, at what point did that trade commence? And when you're tracking flows, because on the timeline, I don't know, I've asked this question to multiple people, like who was actually predicting we would be all-time highs and rates unchanged at like 5.5, no rate cuts, and then we're all-time highs. Like you're saying that's all part of ETF trade. A lot of people in the timeline were skeptical of the ETF. It happened. But like at what point were you bullish going into this setup? And like, how are you tracking flows and where are they coming from?
I mean, flows, you can publish them on chain. They're published every day. So you can just look at...
Not just for the ETF, just like generally, ETF. Right? Not just ETF, just like in general, crypto flows.
Yeah, crypto flows, it's pretty simple. You can just look at stablecoin market cap. I think and it's flatlined for a bit now. Hasn't been going up. And then on the ETF, I mean, I think that's what's been driving the market more than anything else. So you just look at the inflows and outflows into the ETFs themselves. And I agree with you that, you know, there were a lot of different opinions on whether the ETF would happen or not. But the overwhelming consensus starting at about 30 to 35K was that it was very likely that the ETF was going to be approved in January. You know, I didn't bottom tick this. I didn't buy 25K, but by the time we broke above 30, we were trading 35. I think that was we ended up getting quite long at my previous fund, and we managed to capture a substantial portion of the rally. Now, when I look at the market, it doesn't really matter when I got. Like, let's say I missed the entire rally. Let's say you're a trader, you're out there, you missed the entire rally because you didn't believe the ETF was coming. Like that approach does that's the past. It doesn't really matter. The reality is that the market went up in anticipation of that trade. So the aggregate amount of people in the market said, we think the ETF is going to get approved, so therefore we're going to bet on it. And then you got that run up to about 50K betting on the ETF approval. Then the ETF gets approved and you get a ton of outflows from GBTC that are somewhat offset by the inflows. And so everybody sells off. It goes from 50K back down to 40. And then what ends up happening is that the inflows surprised everybody to the upside. We started getting a ton of inflows into this market from, you know, brokerages, people were flooding into the ETFs, and that caused everyone to re-rate again and say, oh, wait a second, maybe these inflows will continue for an extended period of time. And so everybody got back in the market, the inflows started helping, and that pushed us to all-time highs. Now what I'm saying is that dynamic has changed, and we're just not seeing those inflows anymore. And so if you're a trader, and you're trying to trade this on a, you know, 1, 2, 3 month time horizon, then it makes sense to de-risk a little bit. Now, do I think that, you know, we're done, that the cycle's over, that we're never going to get to 100K, that we're never going to get to 150? No, of course not. But I'm a trader at the end of the day. Uh-huh. And if I can avoid a 40% drawdown and an 80% drawdown in alts, I'm going to do my best to do that. Right.
Fair.
You know, I don't want to be caught.
Yeah. Ro, you're trafficking, I guess, mostly now in privates, I guess, with Hack. How are you guys thinking about it just in general? I've seen you on a bunch of rounds. We've co-invested together. So like, it doesn't seem like you guys are slowing down the pace of deployment. You're obviously trafficking earlier stage where, like, as we were talking earlier, like the rounds are not getting really out of whack. I think the rounds that are getting really out of whack are like the jump from like 200 FTV to like 2 to 3 billion like a month apart. And you're like, did the tech just become incredibly better? But yeah, how are you guys thinking about it?
Yeah, no, for sure. And also, just to be clear, you know, we're still pretty active on the liquid side. So can touch on Avi's point first. Just real quick, disclaimer here is views are my own and should be only for informational purposes, not relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. All right, now that that's out of the way.
How happy is your lawyer right now, Ro?
Super happy. He's going to...
stoked for Ro.
Plus one Mark, to Avi, me, and Yato. We're all...
It goes for everyone. As far as what Avi's saying, I don't necessarily disagree with it at all in the sense that like 50 after a run-up like this is completely reasonable. I kind of think about this stuff from, especially now, from a more... you know, zoomed out view here in the sense of like risk reward from a 100K sort of bellwether for Bitcoin. So if you're looking at 63, like you're risking kind of like, I don't know, 23 to make 37 here. If you get down to 40, it's even better. Like, you know, maybe risking 5 to 10 to make 60. That feels pretty good. So if you're a type of trader that can de-risk now and then also have the wherewithal to like load it up at 50 or 45 or whatever, sure, go for it. But if you're not going to have the confidence to buy over there or like be on top of it enough to do it, I don't really see a reason to go crazy right now. That being said, like having cash, you know, at least 10-20% of liquid portfolio, I think makes sense for the scenario that Avi described. And the market is chopping and it's not retaking, it's not really painting higher lows per se. So, you know, definitely pretty cautious there. So that's just kind of what I'd say on Avi's front. Like, totally hear you there. Yeah. And then on the private side, yeah, it's pretty much what you said there, Santi. Like pre-seed seed is, there's still some good stuff there. And like the markups aren't ridiculous. And I've mentioned this before publicly. I think when you look back at 21, 22, the sort of most regrettable kind of things you could have done is probably just doing like these larger growth stage rounds that are kind of like BC sort of deals, but are still pre-launch or pre-TGE, pre-product even. That's where you can get into a lot of trouble. So exercising caution on the later stage here, I think definitely makes sense, but keeping the eyes wide open on the earlier stage. So that's kind of the approach here, I'd say. And, you know, there's still ways to structure good later stage-ish deals, but at the end of the day, you really have to be careful here for sure.
Yeah. Question for both of you guys. I mean, you can always make money in any market regime environment, even though we're chopping, there's certain narratives that catch, you know, good and bad, right? Is there anything that you guys are paying attention to, both on the long and short side? Stuff that you really like, stuff that you definitely wouldn't touch? You know, deep end memes, DeFi, different ecosystems?
Yeah, I can go first. I mean, well, one, I think shorting, if you're pair trading-ish, like sure, but generally averse to doing that, you know, cash is kind of a short position in many ways. But yeah, I mean, if we wanted to start on the short side, I think there's some stuff this summer where, you know, you have a lot of supply coming into the market. I won't necessarily name specific names, but the low circulating, high float kind of stuff, eventually, like there's a component of gravity here, and you have to tread waters very carefully there. And a lot of these places are trying to, you know, push back vesting through a variety of different structured deals. So that's like kind of indicative of telling you where they think that this stuff could go. On like the deep end side of things,
on that point, are you looking at like recent launches and how they've traded? And most of them have just really just been down only.
Some recent launches, although others, you know, you could think of like Ondo, Pith, like Zai, even like some of these low float kind of things that have done pretty well since their token has launched. But yeah, maybe more recently.
Smaller though, but like if you look at the larger ones, which tells you like how's the market going to absorb eigenlayers,
exactly.
Of the world, which are billions and billions of unlocked. Like Arbitrum went from 2 to 1.
Yeah.
And the ETH chart looks terrible.
Yeah. The larger,
I have to say, because I'm an investor. So,
yeah. ETH chart, when you price it against Bitcoin, it looks pretty, pretty awful. But yeah, I mean, that thing looks like it's begging to go lower. We'll see kind of where it finds the floor. But yeah, like that, you know, short side, it's really just this float stuff, I would say. Like that's really where you can get into a lot of trouble kind of longing some stuff and then just get absolutely trucked in the order book over time. So alongside, like, I think there's some catalyst driven stuff that could be interesting. Like, for example, like, I mean, this one's been talked about quite a lot, and there's some positioning here that you have to be aware of. But something like Maker, where like there's a clear sort of very telegraphed thing that they're doing that hasn't been done yet. And I think crypto markets, like, generally, yeah, there's some degree of pricing it in, but really, like, the day the announcement happens, like, that's when people actually, most people really realize what's going on. And it's kind of a late follower mechanic there. So like catalyst driven things where there's fundamental changes to either even like token supply splits or what the token does. Like, you can argue something like Jito, Buffalo has, you know, tweeted very hinting at like getting into some other business lines that could drive some narrative outside of just like being a solid validator. And yeah, similar things to that. I mean, honestly, I don't hate Ethereum as well. Maybe that's a contrarian take, like as far as downside versus upside risk goes, because look, there's going to be an Ethereum ETF. And Avi just talked about this whole Bitcoin ETF thing. It's unquestionable to me. Like, if you think Larry Fink is a one-trick pony here, like, that's just wrong. Like, it's a question of really when, not if. So I think you could start positioning into that for sure. And it's been like battered down and hated. But I think the narrative that ETH has today is even better than 2 to 3 months ago, because like people think that there's this hot new thing that works flawlessly all the time, and then reality comes in and strikes. And at the end of the day, on L1, you can always pay for finality, and it's worth something, and it has some Lindy effect. So I don't hate Ethereum, honestly. Yeah, maybe I'll get a lot of shit for that, but
Avi, yeah. What say you on Ethereum?
Okay, so I don't hate Ethereum at all right now. I think that it's actually, just from a price action standpoint, the fact that the market has sold off so aggressively and Ethereum has managed to stay up and actually climb and keep pace with BTC, that's a very good sign. I think that the market has generally been extremely underallocated. I gave my bearish Ethereum pitch a few weeks ago. You know, I think I've been pretty unconstructive on Ethereum just based on the way that Solana has really captured a lot of the mind share away. But I think at this point, sentiment and allocation is so bad for Ethereum that we're heading into a good time for Ethereum to recapture mind share and then prove that out with price action. I think that Solana metaphorically and physically hit its limits. You know, when it stopped working, and I think that made people realize that this thing isn't, you know, infallible, which it seemed for quite some time. It's like, oh wow, you know, Ethereum doesn't really have downtime in the same way that Solana has downtime. And I do think that in the past,
it wasn't technically downtime as before. It was just right. A spam issue, which was now resolved. Yeah. Transactions are landing, but your point is broadly taken. It was just, I want to clarify, it wasn't downtime.
Yeah, not specifically downtime. But I think this, the issue that I've had with Ethereum for a very long time is that I think that the fragmentation into all these different L2s makes it difficult to have a coalesced community. I mean, you have people that are more interested in Optimism, that are more interested in Arbitrum, that are more interested in Base, that are, you know, you had the Matic fanatics for a while that seem to have completely disappeared now. But basically what I'm trying to say is that when you have a fragmented community that all in theory are part of one, but in practice are competitive, that is bad for token price. And it's bad also for usage, because what you get is you just get a bunch of different protocols, a bunch of different apps building on a bunch of different protocols that are effectively the same, that are just carbon copies of each other, right? So do you really need specific applications for Base, for specific applications for Arbitrum, specific applications for Optimism? I think it just dilutes Ethereum, whereas Solana captures everything because it's just one. And I am seeing that still play out. So I don't actually know how that resolves. I'd be curious to get your take on this, Santi.
Are you?
But at least from a sentiment standpoint, Ethereum is in a good position to get reallocation.
I don't disagree. Like, I think the ETF, it's the next one, right? So you could expect similar price action. Like, to your point, like, it's telegraphed, it's coming. There's like six different or plus applications for the ETF. It's going to happen probably sometime this year. And the question, perhaps more nuanced, is, okay, you're saying WeChop, both of you seem to think like we're probably, maybe WeChop for a couple months, you know, there's been pretty significant price action. It always serves to have some cash, you know, to go shopping. For Ethereum specifically, so if you're constructive Ethereum around certain catalysts like the ETF, do you hold spot ETH or do you go long some of the L2s like ARB, OP, or, you know, Starkware or some of the other ones, but primarily the big ones like Arbitrum, Optimism? Like the relative valuation of like ETH relative to an L2, are you long that, short that? Like, how do you think that trades?
I'm personally short it.
You think ETH will outperform the L2s?
I don't know if ETH will outperform the L2s in an absolute sense, but in a risk-adjusted sense, in a liquidity sense, for sure. I mean, you might have ETH up 50% and maybe Arbitrum's up 75% in that same time period, but I'd still rather just buy more ETH.
I completely agree.
Than buy Arbitrum. I think there are just too many idiosyncratic issues with L2s. You just don't know where the activity is going to actually flow. You can make your bets on Arbitrum and Optimism and Starkware and ZK Sync if they launch their token in a reasonable amount of time. But I don't think that, you know, you, if you're bullish on Ethereum, you buy these things carte blanche. You have to really have a specific thesis and be bullish around that specific product. You can't just say, hey, I'm bullish on ETH, therefore I will buy all of these L2s, because I think there's a very reasonable chance that, you know, the supply side overwhelms them, that they don't actually capture user volume. So I'm just, if you're bullish on ETH, the way that I would play it, if you really want beta, is you buy NFTs.
Or buy NFTs, you mean. Yeah. What about something like Coinbase with Base and, you know, they're making a bunch of money through sequencing fees, I believe now. They're going to publish earnings on May 2nd or 3rd. I mean, the stock's got a huge run up, but nonetheless, I'm curious.
Yeah, I don't hate that either. If you land on the fact that you're constructively bullish ETH or something, you have ETF, whatever reason you get to it, and then you figure out some amount of capital you want to put towards that, I would go like at least something like 80%, maybe a little lower, maybe a little higher, into ETH itself. And then you can do some NFTs, some meme coins, Coinbase, whatever, for the tail end there. But you want to be right if ETH, you want to make money if Ethereum does what you think it does. And you can get really tied up if you have that view and then you go express it in L2s or something random and then get run over by an event you hadn't foreseen or an unlock or a holder behaving erratically because the liquidity is just way worse. Mm-hmm. So that's my take on it. And I think Coinbase falls into that for sure.
Yeah. Avi, I want to go back to kind of your current state. What would invalidate your overall bearishness, this idea that we're going to chop for a while? Like, are there some things that you're looking at that might, you know, make you turn?
Yeah. Two specific things. I want to see stablecoin market cap start going up again. I want to see real inflows. I want to see genuine inflows into the ETF and an understanding of why they're coming in. So for example, one way that this could be invalidated is, let's say we get, you know, $300-400 million of inflows into the ETF, and it's coinciding with these issuers telling us that they're ramping up their marketing efforts and they're targeting new types of clients, which, you know, you can call these people up. You can look at their press releases. You can look at what they're saying on Twitter. You can try to figure this stuff out. So that if something materially changes in terms of inflows and I understand why, then that would invalidate my thesis. The other thing that could invalidate my thesis, not around BTC, but around Ethereum, for example, I mean, yeah, if we start getting activity on Ethereum go through the roof, if we start getting if it's very clear to me that there's front running of an ETF on ETH, which is probably ETH BTC going to 0.55, you know, maybe we need to hop on that train and start punting ETH. Or if, you know, there are real breakthrough applications on that aren't just meme coins going up, that are actually generating real users in a meaningful way and real revenue for a variety of different protocols, then that could catalyze a run in itself. You know, so just a few things that I'm always looking at to be invalidated, because like at the end of the day, I'm bullish on the space. I wouldn't be here if I wasn't. True. So I'm always looking for reasons to be bullish. Mm-hmm. It's generally hard to find me.
There's a bullish bias. There.
You know, there's like inherently a bullish bias. So for me to be a bear, it's actually a pretty high bar.
What do you think about Rob? I want to give you a chance to just think about and respond to that as well.
Well, I think those are really reasonable signals to look for. I also will kind of throw one out of left field here. Like, you know, in early December to February, we chopped for about, I was looking at it about 70 days in the 40K range. Currently our 60K range chop, like including the 59.6, is about 57 days. One way to play this thing with vols getting crushed is just by at the money straddles, like go long ball, like into like the next 2 to 3 weeks. Like you could be upside downside. I do feel like the sense of some potential energy brewing, like something's going to happen. And that's kind of a way to play like some sort of move in either direction. So I don't hate that way of, if you're really looking for something to do while you wait for this chop, cause maybe it can be boring. Like I don't hate the at the money implied vols here for Bitcoin. So I'll just throw that in there as like maybe the response.
Yeah, you also don't have to do anything.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
You know, there's
impossible.
There's no crazy. Yeah, I just throwing it out there. You don't always have to be looking for a trade. You don't always have to.
We all just go to Saint Tropez and just Monaco
Grand. Yeah, take me to Saint Tropez.
I mean, look, I'm down, guys. Let's go. It's off season. It's cheap. Let's get a villa.
Yeah, already.
Yeah, dude. I will say when you're bored and like the last thing you do is go long ball like that. That's really the.
How do you square this idea that you don't love the L2 trade, but then Hack is maybe making some investments in like, you know, Eclipse or Movement or Monad? Like those are, I mean, some of those are like EVM L2s, right? Some they're parallelized or they're bringing Move to Ethereum, but like, yeah, how do you kind of square those two ideas together?
Well, I want to be granular about it. If you're, you know, bullish ETH going into like an ETH ETF catalyst, like this cycle, whatever, and ETH's going to go up and you want to express that view, I think ETH's a very clean way to do it. Like Hack, this is a 10-year venture fund cycle here. This is and the price matters a lot. So on that element and scale at the right price, like empirically, you've seen these things do really well. It's kind of hard to ignore that. So it's just different time.
On this point alone, like I've asked this question a number of times, and I've actually looked at the data like across all my investments. If you would have done an infrastructure deal or pretty much any investment sub 50 million fully diluted, it's generally positive EV. You're taking duration risk. Maybe your hands are tied. Sometimes that's a good thing that you can't actually, you know.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to outperform like ETH and Bitcoin over the long term. But generally speaking, like it's all very price like driven, which is the nuance you're talking about, right? Like it's very different if you're investing Monad at 3 billion versus, you know, 100 million.
Yeah.
100, wildly different. And the question I'm maybe Avi not as appropriate for you because I think you tend to traffic more on liquids, but like if you were to, you have a portfolio, you can draw it from scratch today, what would your relative allocation be across just stuff? Solana, you could buy anything. And I want to understand the ratio of liquids to privates. Like how much do you carve out? How do you play that? How do you think about like timing that?
That's a really tough question. I without putting numbers into it, because I might mess up adding up to 100. Well, maybe I can a little bit.
We'll help you. Don't worry.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, it really depends on your propensity. Like, who are we talking about here? Are we talking about like...
Great question. Like, you both are professional money management. And you have size. It's not like... So like, you know, maybe... I think the answer changes on the margin, but just let's assume it's just 100.
Yeah, let's say you're a money manager and you have some degree of value and liquidity. Yeah. So at minimum, I would go at least just start with like keep 50% liquid, of which you're going to want to have a cash position. You can earn decent yield doing stuff like basis, whatever, fire into like 50, 40K if you get there or something like that. Like that's good. So like let's say of the 50% cash position, of the 50% liquid, 20% cash, then the rest you can buy a smattering of Solana, Ethereum, Bitcoin, Coinbase. On the private side then... I would split it up. So that's like kind of
anything in particular in the ratio of like ETH to SOL, particularly ETH to SOL to BTC, like what ratio?
I mean, if you don't want to mess it up, I would go something like probably even split across them. If you want, it's kind of like the when you like do a your wealth front or these robo advisors. If you want a little more risk, I would go heavier Solana. To be honest, there's more upside there. Just sort it by market cap, right? If you want a more middle of the road bag, go Bitcoin, Ethereum. I actually don't hate, if I had to pick one, if you had to put a gun to my head, I would probably go a little overweight ETH, then Bitcoin, then Solana. If I had to pick one of the constructions. And I think a lot of that comes from what Avi was talking about earlier, which is just positioning in ETH and general hatred towards the thing and how awful the ETH BTC chart looks. Like, I'm expecting to be wrong on that chart, but not to be able to find the floor. Like, just kind of being like, it looks pretty bad right now. Like, let's just start. So that's that. On the private side, does that make sense on Liquid? Yeah.
Yep.
On the private side, I think, you know, you have two main things that you could do here. It's like there's the infrastructure, like there's the L1s kind of things or alt L1s, and then there's like more of the application layer, people building things on application on L1s in existing block space. And those, the latter tends to be more like pre-seed, seed stuff, and the former, at least now, is more like growth, although there are some newer ones coming out, but a lot of the big rounds kind of got done. It does pain me a little bit that applications just empirically accrue less value than the L1s because they are so cool and I love taking calls to them. But, you know, depending on the size here, let's say like size is not a constraint, like you're not moving $1 billion here or something smaller. I would, you know, if you can get applications at the right price, like I'm talking like sub 20, sub 15 even, like going like 20, 30%, going like, of that 50%, like let's say 40%, 30% into like applications on promising ecosystems that are coming out relevant in this cycle, which would probably be like Barrachain. You can argue maybe Monad, depending on kind of how that comes out. And then maybe some ones that are like moving to their own L2 or roll up that are promising and have users, like something like a Hyperliquid or whatever it might be. Like those things, you know, at the right price early would make sense. And then the rest I would focus on infra plays like L1s. You know, you have to be dicey there because you have to be careful because a lot of them have been marked up a lot. But look, like if you're thinking on the long term and thinking about the relative value of Solana and Ethereum versus these things, like even some of these pricier rounds or even where these things open liquid, you can earmark that for like day one TWAPs into things that just list. Hopefully, sure. Maybe you get lucky. Maybe some of these things list when Bitcoin's trading at 50. Like, yeah, you're looking good day one potentially there. And then that's kind of how I do it. And then, so that's pretty it. Maybe you could do like 1% into meme coins. Maybe I should throw that in there. Yeah.
Avi, before I go to you, Ro, on this point, just a little bit of nuance. You're speaking from like a fund that has like a 10-year investment horizon. You're comfortable taking duration risk. You're kind of playing. If you're investing in a private round today, it feels like you're probably going to catch it next cycle kind of thing. Is that the general thesis?
Yeah, that's from someone that doesn't feel like they need any degree of liquidity for whatever reason over the next like 7 years, I would say. If you value liquidity a lot, just change that initial ratio. Make it 70% liquid, 30%, and then up the cash position a little bit because of the volatility. So that's kind of how I'd think about it. Generally, it's for, yeah, if you're okay with the duration.
Ave, over to you.
Yeah, I think so. Just to preface this, I still do a little bit of angel investing, and I do think about how to put this into the portfolio. The way that I would allocate liquids right now is, I would focus heavily on making sure that you have cash to buy if things really fall out. So I'd probably be somewhere between 30-40% cash. But if you're allocating, you know, and you want to just say, okay, I'm in crypto, then the way that I would do it, especially if you're looking for, you know, to hold and not trade over the next year, 2 years, 3 years, if you just want to set and forget portfolio, what I would do is I would probably have it something like 30% BTC, 30%, or, you know, 20% ETH, 30% SOL, and then basically anything else that you find valuable on the application side. I probably wouldn't choose any other L1s or L2s to put in that basket, but anything that you think is a good product or you've done research into that, you know, you really like, I would allocate to the application layer across these types, because I do think that if you're going to bet on crypto, you have to make the bet that applications are going to be winners in the future. The whole meme coin game cannot last that much longer. This cannot last another year, another 2 years, another 5 years. There will always be meme coins that will do well, and there will always be meme coins that will make you money. But if we don't have applications, then your investments in crypto are probably not worth anything anyway. So I think it's important to have to have some allocation to this this sector if you're a set and forget kind of person. If you're just a hey, I want to allocate to crypto. I do think that right now allocating to privates is tough, just because you have to be a very talented investor. Like, you know, you have to be a Roe or a Santi to get access to these good deals right now. Otherwise, you're not gonna.
Yano's like, hey, what about me? Yano's silent. Yano's like in the other angels category.
Yeah. Notable angels. Other angels.
I mean, realistically, I just don't think it's at this point in the cycle. Yeah. I just don't think it's reasonable to assume that unless you already have a brand and unless you've already been a good angel, that you're going to get any allocation to any good deal. Yeah. So there's probably a ton of adverse selection to people that are trying to angel right now that, you know, aren't able to provide a ton of value to these projects. I mean, and even if you are able to provide a ton of value, if you haven't in the past and you don't have that reputation, you're very difficult to get in, right? So I think for your, you know, average investor, and even for your average VC fund, it probably doesn't make a ton of sense to be doing a ton of venture right now.
All right, I mentioned them in the pre-roll. Now I'm going to bring them up again. It's Arbitrum. Santi and I are really fed up with these high fees, and we're really excited to have teamed up with Arbitrum for the next couple of months on Empire. As the leading Ethereum scaling solution, Arbitrum now powers hundreds of decentralized apps across DeFi, perps, NFTs, gaming, and a whole lot more. The team has showed us everything in the ecosystem, both now and what's to come, and we're really, really excited about it. Arbitrum allows both daily users and developers to interact with Ethereum at scale with low fees and faster transactions. The way the team got me excited was through portal.arbitrum.io. So my call to action to you is to get started by visiting portal.arbitrum.io. Go experience on-chain like it was meant to be. This episode is brought to you by Aura. Online crime is growing at an alarming rate, and cyber criminals continue to find crypto investors like the Empire community lucrative targets. We've all heard of someone who's fallen victim to some sort of online attack. Aura helps prevent against that. For example, if your online accounts or your passwords were leaked online, or if someone tries to open a bank account in your name, you'll get notified in real time about that. With 24/7 US-based support, Aura's team will be there for you to resolve fraud issues, even if it means getting on a three-way call with your bank at midnight. Not saying I had to do that, but I might have had to do that. So, aura.com/blockwork. Sign up for the 14-day free trial. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details. Aura is the new standard in digital safety. Check them out. aura.com/blockworks. Free 14-day trial. Hey everyone, Santi and I have been talking about Solana a lot recently, and we're excited to have a Solana sponsor of Empire. Marinade is a staking protocol in Solana. I remember when they launched, I think it was back at a Solana hackathon, and they were funded with this 80K grant. It's super cool to see how far they've come. They're the only stake pool today that delivers auto rebalancing, MEV rewards, and automatic downside protection with their new protected staking rewards. You can stake natively or liquid stake with Marinade and get the same high performance delegation strategy that thousands are using already to stake your soul to over 100 of the best Solana validators. Marinade has been live for over 2 years, and they have audits completed by 4 of the top security firms in crypto. The delegation strategy is a first of its kind. So if you're staking your Solana, if you want to start staking your Solana, if you want to get some yield from your soul, start staking today with Marinade. Go hit the link in the show notes. Big thanks to Marinade for everything that they've done in Solana staking land. Go check them out. Go stake your Solana with Marinade today. Hey everyone, Jason here. I know you've been hearing a lot about the intersection of crypto and AI, and that's why I'm really excited to share our newest partner and sponsor at Empire, Scale, a high-performance modular blockchain that's revolutionizing gaming and AI. With zero fees and instant finality, Scale's unique architecture allows for massive scalability and has already saved users over $6 billion in gas fees. The five main takeaways that you need to know for Scale. One, zero gas fees. Two, Scale has instant finality and lack of MEV. Three, the zero gas fee model of Scale is really important for blockchain gaming adoption as gamers don't have to pay transaction costs or have the SKL token. Four, Scale is multi-chain. This design allows for nodes to be combined to create chains and for individual subnodes to actually be removed and relocated, which creates greater security and collusion resistance. And five, Scale has become a really good fit for AI dApps because they're fast, automated, zero fee transactions. Big thank you to Scale for sponsoring Empire. We're excited to partner with you guys. Bridge over to Scale if you're listening to this at scale.space/ecosystem. Follow the journey along with Scale on X at Scale Network. That's at Scale Network. Big thanks again to Scale for sponsoring Empire.
What about, it's an excellent kind of analysis from both of you guys. Really insightful. We've had the Solana auction multiple rounds. Second one closed yesterday. I heard the discount was very, very a fraction of what it was in the first one. How do you interpret that? I think it was like widely oversubscribed. I have two insights in it, or just I read into that and say like most funds are probably underexposed to Sol. And are kind of waking up. There is obviously it has had issues, but I think most funds are like very much Ethereum centric, still are the vast majority. Now there's been a huge price up in Solana. But funds are kind of trying to catch up to the trade. And they're taking, like, arguably, like, you look at that and you say, why don't you just long Sol? I mean, isn't that, like, a strong signal that the market, like, if it's 7x oversubscribed, it's pushing it up. Like, you're willing to, like, the vesting is, like, multiple years, 4 or 5 years. Isn't that, like, a clear signal that you can take and anyone can look at and say, well, you know, in many ways, you think about flows. You have a lot of dry powder from a bunch of crypto funds that didn't get at the auction. Like, is that something that you look at and say, okay, well, maybe there's something here, not to the extent of like an ETF approval and the magnitude of the flows, but also it's a fraction of the size of Bitcoin.
I do think a lot of that, just understanding how funds operate, a lot of it is the idea that one, you can hedge it if need be, at a future date,
sure,
and two, that the yield looks amazing because you're buying it at a discount, right? If so, just using simple numbers, if Sol is giving you 7%, but you're buying it at 50 and it's trading at 150, you're getting 21% on your dollar, right?
Yeah.
And so the yield looks really good from that perspective whenever you buy something that you can stake at a discount. So what I would say is it's probably 70% what you said and 30%, it's a good trade. Like it's
Someone outbid.
What was the vest on the first? So the first price was
same
like
vest, 60
or 65, and the vest was like 4 years or something or five.
Yeah, I will add like the one thing you have to keep in mind here on as well is if you're a natural Sol holder and have had a bunch for a while and you're in like the long term territory, or you know maybe you're in a jurisdiction that doesn't even have taxes, it makes a lot of sense to just sell it and rotate into the liquid. Or into the illiquid kind of thing, and I think a chunk of that flow is definitely recycled, so that's not necessarily net new buyers. So you have to be careful about that component.
Good point.
And the other is, I mean, I was looking at, I think maybe it was Figure, some of these places where they have like a Solana investment opportunity, like just smacked on their front page, and a lot of this flow is like people writing a good memo, reeling in some LPs, collecting some carry, SPV style stuff, where the actual people that did the pitch and like were making a little bit on it, it's relatively risk-free to them. So that's the second thing you have to be aware of. So those things could dampen the, hey, this is like a no-brainer, like good demand situation. Mm-hmm. That being said, I do think it's less than 50, like it's probably less than 50% of the flows that kind of fall into either the two categories there. So on net, mm-hmm. it's probably fine, but there are things that can, you know, you have to like double click into to make sure that like you don't think of this as just pure like, hey, all this is coming in to buy this thing. And yeah, the last price, if the rumors are right, because I, to be clear, was not in it, it seems pretty aggressive. Like within single digit percent of where we got liquidated Wix too.
That was not the case That was the point I was trying to make. It's like, around, it's impossible to time these markets. I'm not one. You guys are more sophisticated in that front. I do pay attention when I see kind of this type of exuberance, right? Where, you know, the amount of capital and the terms matter a lot. And if you're taking something that has over a year lockup, there should be a certain degree of discount. And I understand Sol is like, you know, different than, you know, application or whatever type of investment just by sheer market cap, the discount should be tighter. But still, like, you know, last cycle, like we saw a lot of funds that had no interest in crypto come in late, buy stuff like FTX, and which is no diligence. Like, let's just go. Like, I want exposure. You have now Jane Street has over 5% of all the Coinbase stock. The 13F is also misleading, Ro, to your point, because they might be doing a whole bunch of other stuff on the back end.
Yeah, that's so like when Renaissance owns 5%.
Exactly. Like, you can't just look at that and say, oh, they're incredibly bullish Coinbase. It might be like shorting it or whatever. You know, it's just difficult to just make simple analysis. But nonetheless, I'm curious more of a general question around the timing of the cycle. Like, both of you sort of near-term bearish, still constructive long-term. Feels like there's not been an invalidation of a bull market. You have drawdowns in a bull market. It's normal. Any bull market has had that. I'm curious if there's anything else that you guys are paying attention to in terms of how long this cycle lasts in terms of flows, in terms of inflation and the market's ability to absorb that, applications. Like, how are you guys feeling about generally 2024?
I would just add to that. I would add on top of that question, like, one thing that would be interesting to hear is both your guys' take on comparing this, where we're at today in this cycle, to the last cycle. Like, is this the beginning of 2021? Are we in 2020? Like, where are we relative to last cycle?
I'm a cycle denier personally.
Yeah, I was going to say something like that.
You know,
elaborate, please.
I think that we've, you know, and, you know, crossed the Rubicon. I don't necessarily believe in the idea of cycles anymore. I think that the market participant and the way that Bitcoin trades is going to be radically different from the past. In large part because of the ETF, but also because it's now so large, it's a genuine macro asset. And so I don't think that we'll get those same 80% drawdowns, you know, 10x, 20x, 30x ups. I think that it's much more likely that we get muted drawdowns. And when I say muted, maybe 40%, 50%, and then slow climbs back higher, you know, with shorter parabolic runs on a march to the right over the course of the next 10 years. That's my take, is I think that Bitcoin volatility is going to dampen. Because think about this. Why did Bitcoin cycles happen? Because retail, what they tend to do, and small ticket investors and people that aren't professional investors, what they tend to do is they tend to FOMO in and they tend to FOMO out. And institutional investors do this too. That's why we're not going to lose sight of, yes, there will be periods of massive expansion and then big collapse. But it's going to be muted because institutional investors tend to move more slowly and allocate on longer term time horizons. And that is the now shifting holder base of BTC away from your fast money speculators to people that are allocating as part of a portfolio. You know, and when I say institutional investors, I don't necessarily just mean, you know, the hedge funds of the world. It's a mindset, right? Your person that lives in Iowa that is buying Bitcoin through their Fidelity 401k is much less likely to trade that than somebody in 2017 who's 22 years old and trying to hit 100x, right? And so the composition of people in Bitcoin has changed. And so I think what we probably get is we get a new dynamic that is going to look a lot more like gold than Bitcoin of 2017 or 2021.
Yeah. I'll add to that. I mean, I largely agree with a lot of what you said there. You look at previous commodities, particularly oil and gold, after the existence of a futures market and then in turn spot ETF market, the volatility just naturally dampens over time. And part of that, it's like a maturity thing. So you have structural differences cycle to cycle. And everyone likes to say, you know, maybe this time is different, whatever.
But in this case, like the ETF is a big structural difference, and how that plays out is going to be different. And I think when you think about cycle tops, or like really like what you're really asking is like, when do I sell or de-risk to like save myself from like a 60% drawdown and then like rotate back into. I think if you try to pick that point right now, and if it's like in November of this year, if it's in March of next of the year after, whatever, it's really hard to do that. There are better ways to do it, which is you can just look at the same things each day. And then when the things give you the signals that you want to de-risk, then that's when you can call a cycle. And one of the main things to look at, I think there's this interesting, it's like junglebeat.replit.app. Some kid made this, I don't know. We can maybe link it or whatever, but it's a very good sentiment indicator with like app store rankings and things like that. And you remember November of the last cycle when Disney and Nike and all these brands are saying wag me and friend on Twitter. And when you feel like the reach of that thing, it's pretty good. If you go down to the bottom, there's like this, all the way at the bottom, there's a really good, this thing. Yeah. This thing is really interesting. So I like this indicator quite a lot. Those are the kinds of things you can look for if you're thinking about how to do it. Actually nailed the kind of 70K thing too this year, which is interesting. Those are the kinds of things I look for when you're thinking about how to de-risk. But yeah, I can't say with a straight face like, hey, March of next year is going to be the top for X, Y, and Z macro reason, and my expectations of the Fed, all this stuff changes, and you have to be just, I think, hyper aware in the moment.
Ro, how do you think about, so the last cycle can largely be credited to credit, I think, whether it's like, I mean, Genesis's book got freaking insane, obviously. You could say Luna and Terra was like a version of credit. I heard you talking about that on another podcast. You know, BlockFi, Celsius, like it was a very credit-driven cycle, I think, in 2021. Market basically boomed in 2020, and then credit led the rest of the cycle, I would argue. So right now we're not seeing that. You're seeing a lot of I think pent-up demand for credit, but the supply has not come in to fill that demand. So what's your expectation for like how credit evolves and drives this cycle?
Yeah. So one thing I'll start with is I think humans will always try to price a yield for a credit risk. Like it's a natural thing that you always perennially do. So to that end, credit will come back in some form or another, and it's starting to in its early stages. I think it'll just be done in a lot smarter way. Like there used to be this significant element of trust in crypto credit markets, which is, you know, it's sort of ironic relative to what crypto actually is, but things kind of just happen. And there was like, hey, like locked, you know, if you want to lend against locked warrants and, you know, random things like that, isn't really liquidatable good collateral. People did it. Obviously like the Grayscale thing was a big part of that. I think now there's just generally more awareness around what is good collateral and how you can liquidate it. We even saw it over this weekend with Renzo, ETH, DPEG, yeah. Quite a lot. Some of this stuff is pretty illiquid, and so you have to be really careful. I think like stuff like something like Morpho. What they're doing is kind of cool, where they're like, hey, you can isolate this risk for lending pools into these specific sort of vaults and with managers of risk that do the thing. And you as a lender can choose which one you want to be exposed to. And it sort of segregates this whole thing out into these sort of silos where like, you know, one can be more risky than the other, but there's no contagion risk between the two. And I think generally smart contracts help facilitate that structure of credit markets. The problem you had before was that all this stuff was bundled into one sort of net pool of contagion prone credit. So I think the future is more calculated. It has better collateral, of course, but also more isolated collateral and less contagion risk and more on-chain versus off-chain and less lending against locked warrants or SAFs or anything like that. And I think that's the healthy sort of rebuilding of the credit market that will occur. But it's going to take some time. It's going to be slow. And yeah, like a lot of people, I think GCR tweeted this. He's seen a lot of people get burned by just looking for one thing in life, which is yield, right? So like, there's this element, like crypto is volatile innately. And if you're bullish, the thing like owning spot is already a form of return quite a lot. Like you don't need to complicate it by earning maybe like an incremental yield on your Bitcoin for taking some crazy risk on some Bitcoin L2 with a trust assumption you don't understand. So there's been that shift, but I do think what I said before, it's going to rebuild in a healthier way in more isolated, smart contract enabled functions to reduce contagion risk and come back in a better form.
Do you guys think that revenue, like there's like fundamentals in DeFi will matter this cycle or no? Yeah, people, like, there's a lot of like maker revenue charts floating around Twitter, like makers capturing, I think 40% of the fees in DeFi right now. Like, will these matter at all this cycle or no?
I think in the long term. Yeah, go ahead, Avi. Yeah,
I think they will. I mean, you already see it with Maker, right? It has outperformed a lot of DeFi, just by virtue of actually being a good product. I think that it's, you know, unfortunately dwarfed by the gains that you got from meme coins, but it's proven out that people do actually care about good products. And, you know, I think that moving forward, what we kind of need to see is we need to see gains in other non-productive areas go down. And then you'll start to see the market care a little bit more about, you know, things like revenue, things like good products, because they're going to have to put their money somewhere. And it's a matter of when they're, you know, the reason that it quote unquote doesn't matter is because if you can hit a 10x on a meme coin, then you're going to do that instead. But as that starts to dry up, which I think it will over the next year, this is going to start to matter a lot more. Mm-hmm.
When you say non-productive, this reminds me a lot of like Charlie Munger, who was critical of games. When you say games, are you talking about like meme coin trading games or just gaming in general? And how do you make the distinction between what is productive and what is not productive to the crypto economy?
I would say if it's solely based on other than BTC, if it's solely based on Greater Fool, and there's no actual product there other than community. Community is obviously very important, but the way that I would just say it is if there's no other product than community, then it's an unproductive asset. So I'm thinking of your Shibas, your Doges, your, Pepe's,
Picasso's, anything that is sold in Sotheby's for that matter.
Yeah.
Unproductive.
Yeah.
Entertainment value is not productive.
I think, look, you know me, I do punt meme coins. I do buy these things. I'm not saying that they're not going to, that they're not going to go up. In fact,
can go down. I mean, the question whether they go up or down is irrelevant to whether they're productive or not.
But I think that I do the way that I would describe it is I don't think that crypto can survive if it's comprised of solely, you know, entertainment value. I think it actually needs to be value. You know, it needs, in order to grow past where it does today, it needs productive assets like Maker. To really push through. I mean, I think that there's just an upper ceiling that we're probably close to in terms of non-productive asset. I mean, $100 billion worth of value, $200 billion. I don't think there's $1 trillion here, right? In terms of non-productive value that can be created by the market.
Yeah. To that end, Avi, I think there's been a pretty promising sort of cultural shift in the way I've seen tokenomics get constructed, especially at the earlier stage here. I think part of it comes from the fact that Uniswap has put out this proposal for potential fee switch. You know, how that plays out regardless, like that's out there. And then DYDX moved to this app chain model, which is quite promising. You're starting to see more, I think, places just be less scared of like not doing like just a pure governance token and kind of wishy-washy figuring it out later. Like they're willing to take the risk and actually drive value to the token. And I think it matters less, honestly, at the earlier stage. Like no one cares. Like you keep it, governance, whatever, it's fine. Like you're not making huge revenues. But it is really interesting to see when things get big, like Maker, like Uniswap, that and like DYDX, they're making that shift. And I think that's the promising part on the fundamental side of things. And I think over time, like objectively, that will matter. And I don't think meme coins necessarily need to die to make that happen. Like they can exist tangentially. Like you know, maybe you could capture some flows to meme coins to that, but I do see that trend kind of formulating right now, and I think that's promising on the fundamental side. I think, you know, the original question was maybe more related to like indicators and signals and so for like mature stage things that are thinking about putting their token into a more value accruing state. Like I do think like, yeah, looking at some of these, how much fees are paying and like what reasonable split could go between the token versus like, you know, fees to LPs or other participants on the platform. Like that stuff I think is quite relevant and less people look at that. But I think it's a mistake to look at it when something is in its nascency. Like it has to be more mature to flick this on. Like no one cares if you're making 100, 200K, like it's gotta be big. The other things I look at is like ETHI a lot, like ETHI discount to spot. Like that could be quite an interesting trade coming up. It's pretty deep. And I think that's a function of sentiment and ETF sort of doubts. But I mean, historically, the GBTC trade, you could have bought Bitcoin at like 9K in the bear or something like that.
Best trade ever.
Yeah. And Bitcoin has done this whole thing. And like Ethereum's going to let you do it again. And also the same products like ETHI versus GBTC. Like
I heard Solana too. That's pretty huge discount as well.
Yeah, there was a big premium. There's a discount. The thing is, that one's pretty thin, I think, like as far as float goes. So, yeah,
fair point.
Kind of see. So, ETHI discount is definitely one. I panic less on big exchange flows. I think those get like kind of a lot of hype on Twitter. Like, oh, like big wallet moves X to Y. Mm. Sometimes it's fine for majors. I think it matters less for smaller market cap coins. Like, yeah, there could be something there, but for majors, I think. Yeah, that's super short term and a little bit, I think, overhyped relative to what kind of signal and actionable insight it gives you. And then obviously there's the usual ones. Basis is probably still the most important one historically. And moving forward, there's like never a day where I'm not looking at funding rates. Like
yeah, just, funding rates for me are the most important. And then like also like stablecoin yields in money markets like Aave and Compound. Maker.
Yeah, that's
like
a good one.
If that goes out of hand, you just know people are going really long and just and where those flows are going also.
Yeah, that's underappreciated for sure. The latter.
Yeah. I'm curious. I mean, Ron, you got to go in a bit, but
I'm good.
Yeah, okay. No cool. Worries. What do you guys think the market or just general market participants are getting really wrong or have gotten really wrong, particularly as of late?
Ooh, I have one. I'll go first. I think. I mean, this is going to be controversial. I think Bitcoin DeFi, that's the one that they've gotten wrong. And I think there's this narrative that OG Bitcoin holders are going to wake up out of the, you know, villas of Saint-Tropez and start using DeFi because they can canonically do it. At the end of the day, when you think about these things, one is if you have block times for whatever Bitcoin L2 you're building, and they're faster than 10 minutes, there's some trust assumption in there at minimum. And some of these L2s look no different than Ethereum for what Ethereum is to Bitcoin, as that's this Bitcoin L2 is. It's just branded in a way that it makes it seem adjacent to Bitcoin. If you do have 10-minute block times, there are generally less trust assumptions, but still something there. Like maybe it's an off-chain index or something that's computing smart contract code. And no one asked for DeFi, but 10 minutes and slower and more painful to use before. This is not like, I don't think this is unlocking new Bitcoin OG holder liquidity. And I think you have the same pool of Bridge Pro PVP capital sloshing around in these Bitcoin, areas. And I think that's apparently controversial because a lot of people think it. I get the positive side, which is like, look at, you know, ETH L2s versus ETH. But
I found it too. I generally agree. Like most of the pitches have seen from these people trying to build an L2 on Bitcoin, I'm like, you fundamentally don't understand the Bitcoin holder. Yet again, so like if you look at like DeFi summer, peak DeFi summer, you had like Badger, you had TBTC, like WBTC, like people could bridge over to Ethereum. The core majority of Bitcoin holders are like, no fucking way I'm going to bridge my stuff over to this shitty ecosystem with smart contract risk. But ironically, they ended up depositing a lot of their stack in things that blew up like BlockFi.
Exactly.
So I see the aggregate size of BlockFi and the deposits that they were able to gather as kind of a good proxy, not just BlockFi, but like Void, like some of the other players. Because ultimately a lot of Bitcoin holders were just more comfortable or just wanted to capture some yield, to your point. It just at some point gets at you. I'm not saying the entire market, but so I do think like there's some technical debt of like stuff like stacks and stuff like that. I think new designs, I mean, obviously bias because I've invested in two, but I do agree with you. The nuances, most designs are just because you hear a lot of teams saying, well, look at the L1, L2 stuff. Like most people are punting in optimism. They don't even have fraud proofs today. Even off-chain labs disclose some vulnerabilities in the fraud proofs that are in beta. Like without fraud proofs, it's a multisig. It's just a huge amount of risk. And people are saying, oh, you know, that's going to be the same with Bitcoin. I agree with you. That's likely not going to be the case. They're probably overstating the market size, at least.
Yeah. And for now, a lot of these things look like, hey, stick your Bitcoin in this little box, lock it up for 30, 60, 90 days and get this other little thing. That's not what Bitcoin OGs want. They don't really, they just want like protection, purchasing power and like inflationary long-term stuff. Like they don't want to put their Bitcoin against some random token in an AMM but feel comfortable about it because it's all running on Bitcoin. And I do think the existence of BlockFi or stuff like that, where like, yeah, on one hand, they did go into that, but the fact they blew up doesn't really, I don't think help the case here. Like that part happened too, right? So yeah, I'm not necessarily super like net bearish on it. I think the hype relative to reality needs to be tempered, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think that's a reasonable take. I think the one area where I'd probably disagree is I do think Bitcoin NFTs have lasting and staying power.
I was going to say,
of the permanency.
I agree with that too.
I agree with you on Bitcoin DeFi. I think for me, and I'm very curious to hear everybody else's take on this because this is somewhat loosely held, but I haven't found any good arguments against it. I'm pretty bearish on the idea of restaking. I know everybody gets super excited about it. And everyone gets up in arms, but I just don't see where the demand side is really going to come from to justify the crazy valuations that people have assigned to these types of products. And so all of the hype around these, you know, Renzos of the world and Eigenlayers, and I don't see how they justify the valuations that they have based on the expected demand for, you know, the ETH that's restaked. And so I think we're going to have a reckoning where all these things are probably down 80% over the next year.
To your point, I agree with you. I think it's unproductive. That was my question around like how do you define productive use of capital? Because people are like, Eigenlayer is sort of the saving face grace of like Ethereum this cycle. It's sort of like has reignited all this interest. People look at TBL and deposits in Eigenlayer. It's like, so what? Okay, you're going to take it's like all financial engineering, but what's the actual productive use case of it? Some designs like I get like Ethos, which is trying to like lower the security cost to spin up an app chain using restaked ETH. Like, okay, like I get the like shared security model, like allocating that perhaps more efficiently, like in principle, but I do agree with you. That's different than I think the whole other component, which is just like restaking. And it's just yield on yield on yield on yield. And it's sort of we know how that ends. I mean, in my mind, I think meme coins are vastly more productive from an onboarding perspective, from an attention perspective. Arguably, yeah, like regulatory stuff, like people are critical of the industry, like it's on the margin, but I think they are more productive in that sense than restaking. Like,
Santi, I think I got to take the other side of that one. Right, like, fine. If you're...
What's the productivity of restaking? Restaking it 10 times, like recursive leverage.
The productivity is that if you're an operator or you're a founder today and you want to go start something, like I don't know, Ro, I saw you guys invested in Alignment or like Aligned or whatever it's called. Like they're
in there, Rome, yeah.
I invested in Rome too. I'm not, distinction between Eigen and like everything else that is now on top of Eigen, like doing the nth recursive leverage on your ETH. That like this new
you're
one.
Talking
there's
about
there's the leverage. There's two sides of this. There's the leverage. Okay, so today there's like 10 billion restaked on Eigenlayer or whatever it is. 15 billion. I don't know the actual number. 15. You guys like Avi makes a great point. Like there are not enough AVSs in the world that need that 10 billion. So what's going to end up happening is like Eigenlayer needs to keep incentivizing people to do this restaking, and there aren't enough like AVSs to basically like capture that 10 billion. But I mean, I think that the thesis is that there will be, because like if you're a founder, you're an operator or whatever, and you want to get that security from Ethereum, like the easiest and the best way to do that today is to go through, is to just create an AVS on Eigenlayer. So there's like the yield piling on top of each other side of this, but then there's the like, it does bring some productivity to the industry because it's the best, or maybe not the best.
No, I'm not disagreeing that shared security, I think shared security is a novel construct. I just said that. especially for like something like Cosmos. Look at ETH. Like, yes, not just ETH as a collateral. I think generally speaking, shared security brings a lot. It's a big unlock, I think. It introduces some security issues, but I'm not arguing that. I'm just arguing the recursive leverage restaking that is sort of like a question going nowhere and adding more fragility to the system.
On liquid restake tokens, like I can see about the fragility and sort of iterative contract risk you're taking there. I think the broader thing here is that crypto go-to-markets just generally, like even restaking space, but also DePIN and some other areas, they tend to be very supply side focused out the gate. And then like there's a big question of where the demand is and whether it comes in or not and how deeply it comes in. In the case of EigenLayer, I do think right now, like, yeah, there's a lot of supply in there. But I think the market will naturally find some equilibrium here when you log in and the ABSs start coming out and you're earning like a very incremental yield to native staking. Like, it's not necessarily worth it for the slashing risk. So capital should logically outflow. And then maybe that equilibrium point is 5 billion. Maybe it's 200 million, where the premium on the interest rate you're earning for providing these ABSs, where you do have some degree of slashing risk, is actually priced correctly. And it'll take some time to find that. But I think for now, for sure, it's way too supply side driven. So that's my thing there, I'd say.
I definitely agree with that. That's a really good point.
Yeah. And my initial statement was just articulating that right now it's way too high and that I'm probably closer to your 1 billion, like that a 1 billion number than I am to a 5 billion or definitely to a 10 billion.
Yeah.
Right. I just think that what we've seen is that we historically, this type of architecture hasn't actually been taken up. In a particularly effective manner. So while in theory it is productive, in practice, did you build a product for nobody? And that remains to be seen.
Good point.
We got to end this on a better note than that.
Yeah. Well, you know, if World War III breaks out, Bitcoin's probably going to 150K.
I don't know about that. Gold is going to the moon, but I'm not sure if Bitcoin is.
Bitcoin's for sure going to the moon in the World War III scenario. No question. So every day we inch closer to that, and every day we inch closer to 150K BTC.
Avi, Ro, let's end on this. Give me your price predictions, end of cycle, not financial advice, etc. For end of cycle, Bitcoin, ETH, and Solana.
Yeah, no, there is no cycle anymore.
End of...
There's no cycle.
Yeah, didn't you listen to the damn podcast?
Give me a year.
12 months, yeah, 1 year from now.
I think 1 year from now, we're probably trading at 85K after a run up past 100.
Okay. What about ETH and Sol?
ETH is probably at five, maybe like 4.5K, 5K. Sol is probably at 400. That's my guess.
Okay. Ro, how do you do?
So I'm back now. Were you asking for price projections?
12 months from now. Yeah, prices.
We're going to have you guys in a year from now. So,
yeah.
What's 12 months from now? April of, okay. I think Bitcoin's probably over 100K for sure. I think ETH's definitely above 5K. Emphasis on, I think, this is not financial advice. I really get scared at the price predictions. And Solana is above two. I think they all break their previous highs and then by some margin. Yeah, that's kind of my take. I also will add on a more positive note, like 12 months out is fine, but on the long term, you really can't lose against the governments inflating their currencies. So yeah, that's ETH 10K long term, Bitcoin probably 200, 250, Solana maybe like 700.
Agreed. Gents, good pod. Appreciate you guys coming.
Great pod.
That was a blast. Thanks
for having us on. Really
Thank
fun.
You,
good combo.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a blast. Really good stuff.
Yeah, chatting with you guys.
Hey, everyone. Jason here. Thank you so much for watching today's episode. Wanted to take a quick second to thank today's title sponsor, Arbitrum. We know you are tired of on-chain experiences that have unaffordable fees and frustrating transaction speeds, and that's why we partnered with Arbitrum. You can experience frictionless trades, lightning speed, and lag-free transactions, all for pennies per transaction. Explore Arbitrum's expanding ecosystem at portal.arbitrum.io. That's portal.arbitrum.io. See you for the next episode.